welcome to This Week in Games, Twig 281, where we read and distill all the weekly game industry news so you don't have to. Here's what we're going to be talking about today. Players prevail with Helldivers 2 versus Sony PSN. Nintendo announces Switch 2 is coming before the end of Q1 25. Unity gets a new boss. Squad Busters gets a shit ton of pre-regs. Spike Games goes to the moon. Okay, all that and more. So I'm your host, Jen Donahoe, strategic marketing consultant at Beta Hat and Jade Inferno. And today we have on our illustrious Twig panel, Philip Black, game economist at Game Economist Consulting.
Hey, hey.
Eric Kress, principal at Gossamer Consulting.
What's up? I'm back.
And queen of product deep dives, Laura Taranto, senior director of product at Big Fish Games.
Hello, hello.
Good to have everyone here. So, Kress, thank you for coming back. And I love that you listen to the podcast when you're out because all kinds of slacks come in.
Number one fan.
What did you think of Ethan's return?
Jesus Christ, Ethan, dude. You make this shit too fucking easy, dude. Too easy. Dude, that fucking Stellar Blade stuff was creepy as fuck. What was that, right? They're talking about nude naked suits on little anime girl characters. Like, people don't wonder why anime shit ain't mainstream, right? It's because of that, dude. It is creepy, you know? Of course, I had to go look it up on the internet, and now I'm flagged by every P site in the fucking planet, right? Now I'm on the watch list, so shut the fuck up, Ethan. Stop talking about your nude anime shit, and God damn it, stop making it so easy to make fun of you. That's it. That's all I got on him.
Okay, good. So all of the other great stuff he said didn't matter. It's just that he's a creepy fuck.
Got this, it. Though? Like, this is what's selling. This is what you're a fan of. You love to bring this up. Like, Goddess of Victory does over $500 million. Like, that's an incredible success. We should talk about this. We should not avert our eyes. This is what's selling. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
I'm on every pedophile watch list for looking up, like, naked pictures of little girls on the internet.
Have you been to Japan?
Yes, that's Japan,
but
that's why
there.
It's never going to be mainstream. I know. That's why it's never going to be mainstream in the West. It's just not.
It's growing.
Naked suits?
It's growing.
Are you kidding me?
It's growing.
Are you kidding me? All right.
Phil, I didn't expect the vehement defense of the creepy fucks in the internet.
I think we got to do honest research.
Look who else is on the watch list. anyway, by the way, I wanted to shill my visit last week, but unfortunately, I cannot. I wanted to actually talk about this unnamed company. I wanted to say what a lovely part of the country it is, but I can't. I also wanted to talk about the wonderful people that I met, but I can't. The company culture, but I can't. Or the strategy, which I agree or I disagree about, which I can't. I also, you know, wanted to talk about what an amazing event it was, but I can't. So overall, I can't say anything, which is profoundly disappointing. I wrote a relatively innocuous script, I thought, but it did not get through the powers that be at this organization that I cannot mention.
I'm so glad that you did or did not potentially have a great time somewhere in the world with people. Good job. Congrats.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very, very interesting.
Well, maybe what you can talk about.
Yeah, this is not going to win me any friends, but I have to do this because I feel like it's my obligation to point out these sorts of things. So I have an A16 update. Evidently, my A16Z, got some attention. And it looks like folks were a little bit unhappy, but maybe I'll make them even more unhappy. So what people were asking me to update is that clarification around the $600 million that A16Z raised for the gaming fund. So the money that was raised for the gaming fund was part of the overall fund raise, right? So it was a percent allocation on a broader raise from the big LPs that invest in A16Z. So it was not the gaming folks that raised the $600 million, but it was the overall fund that raised the $7 billion, of which $600 million was allocated to the gaming. So in order for investors, LPs, to participate in the growth fund, AI and the American Dynamism, I knew I was going to mess that up, part of their dollars had to be allocated to gaming. So does that all make sense so far?
Got it.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's what they wanted me to clarify. It wasn't really the gaming fund raising $600 million, which is still an absurd number, just so you know. Another quick clarification evidently, the $750,000 check is for pre-seed, right? For the seed rounds, I had said that they would not, they could basically take over that round for seed rounds. So that's not accurate. What's accurate is that for the seed rounds, it's open to any other VCs. And A16Z will invest pro rata, which basically means that they can only invest enough to maintain their ownership, which is very similar to the way Y Combinator worked or still does to this day. So it's the A round. This is where it gets dicey. It's the A round in which they can cherry pick the companies that they like the best, that have the best prospects, in which they can basically take over the round completely. And this is happening for at least one investment they're cherry picking. And that's the big difference between this and Y Combinator, which limits their investment typically to pro rata for subsequent rounds, which is not quite accurate, but I'm not going to go into it anymore. They did start doing what A16Z, but they stopped doing that. Anyway, so what bothers me about this is not necessarily good for companies. Like, you know, it's great from a funding perspective, but the company really should be getting different investors at a more mature phase, right? Whether it's strategics, whether it's other venture capitals, other companies that actually can provide services to help them get to the next stage of growth. So this is not really good. And then the other clarification, which is more of a positive thing, which one of the venture capitalists told me, is that the activities of the speed round, the way they're actually doing the speed round, actually could generate good returns, particularly if they take over the rounds on the A side, right? So that's really, really good. But the dollars don't really work out to be enough to justify a $600 million fund, probably like half of that, right? But what the problem is, it creates a lot of zombie companies, right? So if they do not participate or not as interested in being aggressive on the A rounds, then these companies are like almost untouchable, right? Other VCs are not going to look at them. So it creates kind of a problem with some of the companies that they're investing in if they don't choose to be more aggressive on it.
No, it's complicated, but it still sounds like what you and Mishka were saying from a high level stands, which is there is the potential for cherry picking of certain companies. And there's a potential for what you're calling, I like it, zombie, walking dead companies, zombie companies who, if they're just okay, because A16Z is on their cap table and doesn't decide to keep going, other folks might not touch them. Kind of like when Ethan talks about Stellar Blade.
But also, like other VCs, if they know that the best companies are going to be taken over by A16Z, they're not going to spend as much time looking at them, you know, because they know that they're not going to be able to participate. Because they're going to hog the entire round. So if they, you know, so.
Okay. Anyway. So looking at the big picture, there are a lot of, I get Google alerts, a way that I can kind of tell what's going on in the news. And so there's a lot of data reports this week from companies I've never heard of. And this one came up called Data Horizon Research, never heard of them. And it caught my eye because they said the global video game market is projected to reach $720 billion with a CAGR of 12.6% by 2032, right? I've never seen a projection out that far. And as we all know, because you just can't in video games. It's just stupid. So our typical friends at Newzoo, just to give you like the real down-to-earth projection, is $205 billion by 2026 with a CAGR of 1.3%, right? This is kind of where we have felt is a little bit more realistic. So while I appreciate all these generic research companies going out and trying to show the value of the game industry to folks that may want to invest or just get information, like I saw this posted in some of the channels of my clients and I was like, whoa, everybody slow your roll because we shouldn't be using these. Now, again, it's a 2032 to 2026 projection, but Chris, like, isn't this like a little bit garbage and crazy?
It's ridiculous. A ridiculous analysis. They have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And I actually read through a little bit of their press release, and this might be a good indication of what's going on. It says, I quote, Saudi Arabia and UAE are the forefront of video game market due to high demand from the youth population and the high disposable income in the region.
Right.
Well, maybe... maybe someone is supporting this analysis, but evidently it's an Indian group, which clearly has no grasp whatsoever on what the video game space is, because these forecasts are laughable at best. And so I don't know.
Didn't Novik do an analysis where they tried to like do another estimation of the market? Do you remember this?
I was gonna mention that.
I forgot what the multiple
was. I didn't
want to
throw Navik under the bus. It was Bitcraft and Navik. It was like one of the first things that they did outside of crypto, and it was so bad.
Do you remember where the growth came from? was it just accessories that they included? Like, I guess IP? I don't know what else you put in the bucket.
I don't know. Okay. I think they just, I don't know what they did. It was not a well-received piece of analysis, and they do much better work than that, generally speaking. But I think I got in trouble with Navik because of that report, because I actually talked trash about it. And I was like persona non grata for like months, right? But they never copped to it, but I talked to them all
Shocking
the time.
Shocking that you...
We're good.
You talk shit about it. Yeah, so this is my cautionary tale. If you happen to see this report, maybe think twice about using it and just stick with our Newzoo friends.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, stick with Newzoo. That's good advice. All right.
Moving on. Valve is now calling early access to pre-ordered games advanced access. Oh, they're rebranding early access to advanced. Why?
Jen, this is straight out of your playbook. This is straight out of your playbook. What are
you
talking about?
Listen,
this is a beautiful idea. Like, they've been listening to the podcast.
Yeah. Defend that, Jen.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. Like, the early access label is a label. You know, that like that means shit. Why not throw in another label? Advanced access.
Now they're advanced?
They are the most evil monetization company out there, and no one calls them out for it. And I love it. This is great.
I got nothing. I didn't read it. And from a rebranding standpoint, please don't rebrand to the same fucking word.
That was total gotcha for Miss Jen. All right, moving on.
Supercell-backed Hypehype to give creators 100% of revenue from user-generated content. Oh, Phil, you work with them or you know of them.
No, I just like them.
Oh, all right, okay.
I just like them. I'm into them. I think they're doing cool stuff. This is their like first big step in terms of monetization, and that's where the flywheel for UGC starts. And so like, let's see the thing if it spins.
Okay, very cool.
Can you explain what Hypehype is? I haven't heard of them.
It is a UGC platform for mobile. And one of the big things is that you can edit inside of the app. It's a very seamless experience in terms of like finding new content. Yeah, you can think TikTok in terms of like discovery. And they're just very smart people.
So kind of like UEFN, but on a mobile platform, but not inside of a broader game, right? Like there's multiple game types you can create.
Multiple game types. I don't want to speak for them.
Okay. All right. So moving on to Nintendo news, there's actually a tweet or a message from the president of Nintendo where he came out and said, it was really interesting. I've never seen them do something like this before. Like Switch 2 is coming, but we're not going to announce when, but we will announce when before the end of Q1 25. So I think they were getting ahead of the idea that Nintendo Direct, which is coming in June, is only going to cover titles that are in the second half of 24, and they're not going to talk about Switch 2. So, hey, everybody, we're setting your expectations. Show up to Nintendo Direct, but don't really, because we don't really have a lot to show you because there's not much left coming for Switch 1, but don't get excited about Switch 2. Great comms message.
I think they also had to issue something after the whole leaked report. They've been pretty mum on that.
No. This is managing Wall Street and managing the stock, pure and simple.
Got it.
Right? Gave guidance that was absolute shite, right, compared to last year because they don't have a Switch 2 coming this year. And so they need to, like, placate the masses on the hedge fund side and the investor side saying, hey, we're going to announce it this year, right? So basically it's coming next year. So hold on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Buy the stock, you know? And so the stock's only down like 5%, which on the guidance, it should be down a lot more,
yeah.
But now everyone kind of can expect that the next Switch will be out in next year, and that'll help kind of rebound them. And I'm relatively bullish on the prospects of the Switch too, so we'll see.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I read that, and this is obvious, their hardware projection is down 20% this year, yeah. Their guidance. I mean, it's kind of like the announce before the announce of the announce with GTA 6.
I think exactly the same thing.
I think everyone's looking at what GTA did and we're like, ooh, let's announce the announce. This is awesome. Great idea. Yeah. Okay. Laura, what do you got?
All right. I have to say, I do prefer covering investments in M&A and then layoffs and employments and enclosures. So very glad you're back, Eric.
I think he's going to fight you for that. He's going to switch that up.
Mishka normally takes this. So... our friend of Deconstructor Fun, Rena, CEO of Spike Games, they secured $50 million from Moonactive. who now owns about just under 16% of Spike Game shares. Spike is best known for Tile Busters, which was the tile match game with they took all the everything that kind of works in Match 3, applied it to the tile match gameplay. I think with this investment from Moon Active, I fully expect to see a minor revamp of Tile Busters and then hopefully a revenue hockey stick. But we'll cover this a little bit more. We're going to dig into Moon Active later. And then from friend of the podcast, Neil Long at mobilegamer.biz, Supercell and Benchmark have taken part in a funding round for Web3 game startup Games for a Living. The studio was founded by veterans from Activision Blizzard, EA, King, and they raised $3.2 million, bringing total funds raised to $7.6 million. And they recently soft launched a hero battler called Elemental Raiders. I haven't played it.
I'm reserving judgment. All right. Layoffs, employments, closures. I don't know why this is in here, but TikTok is suing, of course, to block the U.S. app ban, which is unsurprising to anyone.
This is going to affect the games, right? Like, don't you think this will have an impact? Like, this is a big debate channel. We've been talking about this. Don't you think that we should adjust forecasts?
Yeah.
Now that this is happening, shouldn't we adjust forecasts?
I mean, No.
Why not? You don't think it's GDP impactful?
It's going to impact the UA environment for sure, in temporarily.
Yeah.
I hope we're cooler heads prevail. We'll see. Yeah. I mean, all right. We could talk about this some other time, maybe with someone that has more expertise here.
But it's a year out.
Yeah.
And the court battle is going to delay everything. And so if anything, the minimum that something would even potentially happen is a year from now.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know. I don't know about this. I have my thoughts about it's so political that it's not really business related, but if TikTok is gone from the ecosystem, it will impact UA environment. But I think the UA environment is improving enough across other channels that it may have less of an impact than you might think. But
yeah,
I'll ask around and see if that's true or not. Okay. This one's a big weird thing to me. And I actually really want to be corrected on this because I don't know Bromberg personally. I think I've talked to him once. But Unity appoints ex-Zynga exec Matthew Bromberg as CEO. Bromberg has like 2 decades of experience in the industry. He was a COO at Zynga from 16 to 22. He also was leadership roles, including GM for BioWare and Senior Vice President of Strategy and Operations for EA Mobile. By the way, those two areas of EA were not thriving at that time, just to be clear. So I'm very confused about this appointment, and I'm not really sure Unity needs Bromberg right now, and maybe I'm wrong. By all reports, though, Bromberg is a world-class operator, but he's also, by all feedback, he's a world-class... don't you think... I think Unity needs a benevolent dictator now, like someone like to charm customers and motivate troops and attract talents. You know, haven't they done the cuts? You know, do they really need another ruthless dictator to manage them going forward? I think they need kind of a visionary to get them kind of back on track and keep them moving, you know?
Mm.
Again, this kind of makes sense if they were about ready to sell Unity. And so they have some guy that's going to, you know, get people in gear and get them ready for sale. But they already had that guy, right? That was the interim guy did that shit. He did all that work. So I kind of think they need a big leader, like a big personality to take them to the promised land, you know, to lead them into a different path. I'm not sure Bromberg is that kind of leader. And maybe I'll hire the right people beneath him. Ironically, you know who the person that makes the most sense is his partner in crime that's at Match right now.
Bernard Kim.
Like Bernard Kim on here makes more sense. Like to fucking, you know, go after these customers that are all fucking pissed off and like sweet talk them, you know?
Well, that reminds me of... Sorry, I'm going to talk about the social media network that shall not be named. So with Twitter, Linda Yaccarino was this leader of the ad business, ad sales at NBC. I think it was NBC Universal. And then Elon hired her as the CEO of Twitter to come in and charm back all of the ad people who had left, right? So I was like, okay, well, I can kind of see that. I thought they might have picked someone from like the ad world because their ad business with Iron Source is where the revenue is coming from. It's not like the engine business is really where it's at.
I know. Yeah, I'm kind of scratching my head here. I mean, and maybe at the end of the day, there's not a lot of operators out there. There are not a lot of CEO people to choose from. But Bromberg, you know, I don't know.
All right.
I don't get the good vibes. Unless they're going to sell themselves to like Microsoft or something, which is possible, right? Or Amazon, or I don't know. Yeah.
Well, let's clean it up. Yeah. I think we lost we had a vote on who we thought would get the CEO, and I think all of us lost that one. No one picked this guy.
Who did we pick? I don't even remember.
Oh, we were like joking with Frank Gibeau or...
Frank actually makes a little bit more sense to me.
I think you had even said the app-loving guy, Adam.
Oh.
Because we were joking, because of the ad business, right? We were joking that someone would come in for exactly this from the ad business. Okay, anyway.
All right, moving on.
This podcast is brought to you by Heroic Labs. You've heard of Heroic Labs by now, and we keep talking about them because in today's mature market, you need every edge to be successful. Rather than spending those precious company dollars on building game tech, focus on building your game and shipping it. Get it into your players' hands faster and grow your community. Heroic Labs is a battle-tested partner and friend of the podcast. Their tech enables you to be flexible, creative, and scale for success. Heroic Labs has your tech stack covered. Whether you're looking for a world-class back-end server, an amazing game development framework, fantastic live ops tooling, or reliable mass scalability, Heroic Labs has solutions for all of these challenges. It's not just us at Deconstructor of Fun praising Heroic Labs. The company works with some of the world's biggest publishers on the most beloved games. Focus on your game, save a lot of money, and avoid tech risks with Heroic Labs. This podcast is brought to you by Sensor Tower. Sensor Tower has acquired mobile analytics company Data AI, formerly known as We All Know and Love App Annie. Four things you should know. Significant advancement, number one. This acquisition represents a major step forward for Sensor Tower. It expands its customer base, mobile marketing, and app intelligence products, and global presence. Number two, undisputed leadership position. Sensor Tower strengthened its position as the leader in digital marketing and mobile app intelligence through this acquisition. Number three, combined insights. This merger with Data AI allows Sensor Tower to offer customers even stronger and more detailed insights on the digital customer journey. And last, consumer trends. With increasing time spent on digital channels, the combined company is well positioned to capitalize on the growing trend of in-app purchases driven by platforms like Google, Meta, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and Snap. Exciting times lie ahead for Sensor Tower and Data AI as they join forces. If you're a customer, reach out to your account director for more information. Not a customer yet? No problem. Schedule a call to explore the innovative digital marketing products they offer. Go to Data AI or SensorTower.com and get on board with undeniably the best data partner in the business.
Okay. Belka Games lays off 20% of the workforce as it becomes more critical of future titles. I don't even know what that means. I don't know Belka very well. Take-Two shut down Roll 7 and Intercept Games, and the private division is suffering layoffs. I honestly, in today's market, this makes total much sense to me. It doesn't really make sense for Take-Two or these big publishers to be investing in small games. I think it's good PR, but it's not good business where the market's at right now. I know people don't like that, but I just think that is true. And actually, along the same lines, so it's ironic. Now I'm talking out of two sides of my mouth here, but like for Take-Two, it does not make sense to make small games. On the flip side, like the whole Microsoft, I'm sorry, now it's a big rant. So Microsoft is closing Redfall developer Arcane, Hi-Fi Rush developer Tango, GameWorks, and Roundhouse Game is like consolidating. So basically, in essence, they are fucking annihilating the entire acquisition of Bethesda, besides the core group that does like Fallout, Starfield, etc., and id, right? It looks like id is still whole to some degree. It's like, dude, fuck you, Microsoft, right? Fuck Phil Spencer, dude, he promised that they are building out teams to build out the subscription service. Like the whole point of buying these teams is so they can build creative content for the subscription. So what the fuck is going on, right? And so Even the guys at Kotaku, right, were like, what the fuck is going on? And they wrote this article basically saying, it's time to stop giving Xbox Phil Spencer a pass. It has been long motherfucking time, dude. Like, Phil Spencer is driving this thing into the ground, right? It's like, under his, so it says, under his leadership, many have lost jobs and fewer games have been made and out the door. It's time to acknowledge that Xbox boss Phil Spencer is making bad decisions. You think? I mean, come on, dude. What is happening, right? Their whole strategy was to build out studios, to build out a service, to build online capabilities, to build a subscription service. Like, that was their whole fucking strategy. Right now, they're shutting down all these studios that are making really high quality games that people love. You know, like, absolutely, people love Hi-Fi Rush. Like, that was an absolute darling of the industry. And it's like a relatively successful game. And now they're shutting down the studio. They're not even like cutting, they're shutting it down completely, dude. Like, this is just another example of the model is not working. Like, this subscription model is bullshit, right? And Microsoft is failing. And it's like, when is anybody going to take to account for this stuff? Anyway, I can't take it anymore. It's driving me insane. All right.
This is a lot of closure. I guess, why would you not try to sell the Hi-Fi Rush developer Tango Gameworks? Because that game was a darling, it was really innovative and different. Why wouldn't you like put them up for sale? I guess if you're Microsoft, you don't care. You're like, I mean, they've already laid off, what was it, 1,900 people a couple months ago when after the Activision merger went through. I don't know if these were included in that number or not. Actually, I don't know if these are incremental layoffs, so to speak, to that. But Chris, any idea? Like, why wouldn't you try to like sell it, get money for it?
Trying to acquire a Japanese company can get messy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That could have been it.
Okay.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, this is exactly what I was saying months and months and years ago, is that the subscription model does not fucking work. Like, the revenue that you get from subscription minus the cost of making all these games is not profitable, right? That the unit economics don't fucking work in gaming for subscription type services. And so this is a simple calculation. It's like, we're spending all this money on game development. Which teams can we cut to make that dollar number lower so that we become more profitable? I mean, it's that simple, right? And so, like, everything else is just is bullshit PR, right? Like, that's what's happening. Like, the subscription model is not working. They just spent a gajillion dollars. And not only is spending forget the $70 billion they spent for Call of Duty. That's irrelevant, honestly, from a P&L perspective. But what's relevant is now all the costs associated with King and Blizzard and Call of Duty are coming in their P&L, and they have to justify all those costs. And now it's even less, far less profitable than it was before they acquired them. You know what I mean? It's like, so that's what it is, really. It's dollars and cents. It's and cutting makes far more sense than the effort to like try to sell something, maybe. But it's just a shame, you know? It's like, what do you think is going to happen type thing? This is, if it's not nearly as bad as Embracer, but it's getting there, you know?
Got it.
I'm hoping that Phil Spencer will take, you know, I mean, he's got to take blame for all this shit. He's been fucking managing this shit for 10 years, you know? This is all on his watch, you know? All right.
Moving on to some games that aren't shut down.
Squad Busters has announced that it has 20 million pre-registrations and 30 million in its sights with 27 days to go. Jen, I don't know how to think about pre-registrations right now. Like, COD Warzone got a bunch, but it looks like it didn't translate to that much. Does this mean anything?
So pre-regs typically convert better than they did for Warzone. Because we talked about this a little bit. We were like, why didn't Warzone convert? So what I noticed was that the download for Warzone was 4 gig and then another 3 gigs when you actually open up the app. And so if you imagine pre-reg is happening in countries where you're just not on Wi-Fi, you have to actually pay for your downloads, that might be a problem. So maybe in a lot of countries, the conversion just slacked off there. Then there was a ton of reports of performance issues, crashes, inconsistent frame rates, graphical glitches. And then, you know, maybe a lot of the devices weren't compatible. So one of the things I learned when we were launching TFT is we have a really vibrant community in Brazil. But in Brazil, a lot of the phones are a lot older and couldn't actually run our game. And I imagine with this type of performance, right, because Activision came out and said, we want this to be a really high-performing game, that a lot of the devices that pre-reg the game actually couldn't run it. This is my guess of what led to that. And Squadbusters, most likely, I didn't look at the download size for this or the performance specs, but Supercell makes games that works on mobile phones. Like, they know how to do this, where, you know, the four studios trying to pull Warzone together probably that make games for console typically might not have, you know, factored that in. So anyway, does that, how does that sound as a reason why conversion sucked on that game?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, I'd love to check the DAU numbers to see whether or not they're like suffering in those countries. But yeah, sure, I buy that.
And then battery life too. I also saw all these reports of it. I didn't realize that you can actually hurt your battery. If you play a game for a really long time, it kills the, you know, the battery width. So,
and Warzone was like a hot pancake when you played that.
Yeah,
phone got really, was really warm. I think you could like heat my lunch.
Squadbusters, especially because Supercell knows how to do the marketing for this, I think they're going to hit 30 million. They might even surpass it. And I would estimate the conversion being pretty solid. I think they'll probably get between 60 to 70% conversion on the down. This is my projection. You know, I'm going to be crass.
Has anybody looked at the metrics on this game? It's not monetizing at all.
I didn't say anything about making money.
I don't think you can say anything about Supercell soft launch games now, because so many people are like VPNing into the soft launch countries. There's such a big brand following. It's hard to know what's noise and what's real here. So I think like all those metrics just seem fake to me. I don't think they're predictive of anything yet.
Really?
Like, right. They could also be very generous with the economy during this period. Maybe they tighten it up a little
bit. Right.
I really want to see how this monetization engine runs. Like, it's going to be very interesting.
It's coming out in a few weeks, man.
Yeah, it's never been a more pay-to-win concept. I've never seen it as pay-to-win as this. And it's if this works...
That's good.
Chris, that's good.
Pay-to-win is back on the menu.
Dude, pay-to-win's always on the menu.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? It's like, that's mobile, right?
May 29th is the projected launch date. So we'll see.
Hades 2 has launched. It is in early access and is already climbing up the Steam charts. We'll have more to say about it next week. But this is, of course, based on the original roguelike, which sold, I think, millions upon millions of copies. So they've come out with a sequel. Let's see how it performs. Speaking of seeing how things perform, X Defiant is finally going to be live on May 21st. I have been waiting for this day. Ubisoft has really taken its time to get this out the door, but it's happening. They're shipping a game.
Is it on?
Dude, it's not on Steam. It's not on Epic. It's only on for PC anyway. I think it's only on Ubisoft's client, Uplay.
Oh, really?
Why would you do that? Why would you limit distribution in that way? That's insane.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
That's so dumb.
I searched for it. I couldn't find it. And I'm like, this is bullshit. Ubisoft Connect, dude. I don't want that shit on my PC.
Yeah, that stuff's awful. Microsoft sales down 30% year over year. This is Xbox hardware sales. Like, when I look at the reason for Microsoft's decline, like, yeah, you need to ship more units. Tencent's Dungeon and Fighter mobile game will launch May 21st. This is based on like one of the all-time best performing games ever in the world, and it took them what, like, seven years to get this thing out on mobile. That's crazy. It's just absolutely crazy, and it's gonna destroy in China, of course. So if we close out April with some analytic updates, Brawl Stars is still tearing it up. It is the second most number of downloads in the United States over the last 2 weeks, according to Sensor Tower. It's performing at nearly $30 million worldwide, and we don't know what web stores are. So this is just looking at net revenues on Sensor Tower. They could be performing even more revenue when we include web stores. They've already made more in 2024 than all of in 2023. Holy shit. Like, congrats to them. They're absolutely killing it right now. I don't know what the ceiling is this year, but it looks like incredible performance so far. Monopoly Go, just an update there. It's flatlined at about $22 million a week, which puts it at around a $1.1 billion run rate. That is like in the pantheon of all-time great mobile franchises. Like, I think we could almost put it there now. Like, Candy Crush, Pokemon Go, Clash of Clans. Like, Monopoly Go is like cementing its place. And I also started to look at Coinmaster, which is also compared to... And it's been relatively stable over this period. It's just that Go Go has monetized so much better than CoinMaster has, but they've started to align in terms of active users. Monopoly Go has flatlined quite a bit, which I've been surprised by.
Well, before you move off of Monopoly Go, quick future shill. So I'm going to be speaking with Ben Webley, the CMO of Scopely, on Friday in a couple days. If you have any questions you would like me to get in, you guys, let me know. We're approaching everything from a marketing angle, you know, how to scale your soft launch to launch, how to build out your marketing operations to support all that. So you guys on this podcast, let me know if you have questions.
Quick FYI. So I was looking at the Q1 numbers, and it looks like Sensor Tower has the market up like 15% year over year.
Mobile?
It's like the largest market for the US ever, even in 2021, right? But Data AI has the market up 5%. Part of it's because they don't know what Monopoly Go is doing in theory. And so they're basically extrapolating. And then that kind of filters down with their system. So there's a lot of interesting numbers that are floating out there. So it looks like things are go, go, go. But without Monopoly Go, the market would be up like 5% in the US, according to Sensor Tower. But like, yeah, I don't know. I'm actually a little bit confused. So anybody that has like Clarity, you know, like our data people or Sensor Tower, I'm sure they're so busy with integration that they're not going to listen to me, but things are a little off.
It's difficult for them. Everything that I've always heard when I've talked to them is anything at the very top is very difficult for them to extrapolate unless they get direct information, which I don't think they do from almost anybody anymore. If you're down lower, like, you know, in slot 11 down, then it's so much easier. So sorry,
100%.
Phil.
And so, and they're also trying to, match the data that's being reported by Scopely themselves, right? So they have to incorporate that. And so that makes it even higher. I don't know.
So it hasn't really cannibalized anything, though. That's what I find that seems to be incredible. It seems to be all additive, right? This is just growing industry GDP. That is crazy. That is unbelievable.
Yeah. The fact that CoinMaster is still going as strong as it always has is a good call out, right? That's pretty amazing because it is identical.
We don't know a lot about these players, though. Like, who are the players that Monopoly Go added that were not playing mobile games before and not spending? Like, we don't know anything about those players. And if this is, like, the largest source of growth in this industry, like, we should understand more about that.
Yeah, I mean, Solston, friends of the pod, I asked them to help me understand this question. And a little bit about probably what I can say about them is they are casually oriented players and they behave a little bit like merge players, actually. They have a lot of the same, you know, outlook as the old school Pogo players, Chris, if you remember Pogo, which is, you know, older people who want to do coopetition, which is the idea of like, hey, I want to work with other people and play a game together and feel like, you know, I have a little bit of an online community. There's a lot of kind of partner or positive play going on where you're teaming up with people. In fact, and I think that report we talked about last week, the Liftoff report, they talked a lot about some of the mini game events that you're seeing in these games starting to really go after the idea of how do you team up with other people against a common goal. You even see this in Royal Match with the dragon egg thing, which is some weird event that you do where you have to work with another person to achieve goals. So, but I think that's a great question, Phil, is this the first time we've really seen something be incremental? We know Genshin and Honkai cannibalized Genshin in the same space, but in casual, is there the opportunity to create new games that actually grow the business incrementally?
Puzzle's been growing. So yes, and to go back to affinity between games, 100%, there's a big affinity between, excluding the types of games for hyper-casual, merge players like Match 3 games, not all of them, simulation games, anything like the Heydays, those players also like merge games. Merge is super versatile in terms of capturing audience share. It's exactly why, and we'll talk about this with Moon Active, it makes sense for Moon Active to start going into the casual space because you can move those players around. And we see it with games like when we talked about Whiteout Survival. They're starting to capture audiences that were not necessarily defined as 4X, but the way they've done onboarding and the way they've brought in, they've casualized it, makes it a lot more appealing for growing and bringing in players that normally wouldn't play, wouldn't pay, that are doing both of those things. And I think Monopoly Go is doing that in the sense of that game is so easy to pick up and play. Jen, you've talked about this. what was, I can't remember what you called it. I call it the onboard ramp.
Well, signposting, the ability to direct you around the game very using that very clear and crisp UI that helps you understand how to navigate around inside the app. It's something that's actually not very easy to do. You have to have really good UI folks that really think through the player experience to help you go through very clearly. We did it poorly at Scopely. We were actually, I mean, we had a whole project. That's why I know it's signpost. And this is what we called it, because we were trying to fix that. Because the games were a lot older at the time when I was running them. You know, we'd already had like our third birthday, which in mobile at the time in 2018 was like, that was a big deal for a game to be live that long. But yes, no, absolutely correct. Well, you did a lot of this stuff, right? Like you've worked with a lot of folks on trying to really, well, this is your whole hybrid casual rant, right? Like this is, how do we take some of these easy mechanics, add some depth to it?
Yes, ask me about Drill and Collect. It's amazing. I'm having so much fun with it. Everyone should play Drill and Collect. This is my spare hobby. It's an incredible game. I want to talk about it a separate period. That would be my shout out.
All right. So another place to find games that you wouldn't maybe expect to find games to get an audience. Laura, you want to talk about playing some games? I tried this. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll keep it super quick. So I assume all of us check LinkedIn probably daily, maybe the average person a couple times a week. If you haven't, FYI, they've announced 3 new games. So LinkedIn, I think, is testing becoming some sort of gaming platform. And if you do well in these games, and I'll describe them in a moment, you can share them with your entire professional network. So the 3 games are Pinpoint, which is very similar to New York Times Connections, Cross Climb, which is just a word ladder game, and Queens, which is, I would call this a simplified version of Sudoku. They are seeing an opportunity for what New York Times has already identified, and they are going hard after that, trying to convince Wordlers there's more to life than just a daily Wordle.
I'm so excited to play games with you guys on LinkedIn. Let's do it.
I wish they had profile cosmetics, though. That'd be kind of fun.
Oh, I'm sure all of that's coming.
Chris, you don't want to make fun of this one? This is so like up your alley to make fun of.
Nah, I'm moving on. All right. Whatever.
Okay.
Soup du jour. More games is good. How about that?
More games is good. Okay. This podcast is brought to you by AppsFlyer. In today's digital world, understanding your app's journey from discovery to download is more than just insightful. It's essential. Enter AppsFlyer, the leader in mobile attribution and marketing analytics that allows you to measure the full potential of your marketing efforts, making every ad dollar work smarter. With AppsFlyer, that's your new reality. Dive deep into data-driven insights that reveal exactly where your users come from and how they'll interact with your app. AppsFlyer, where your app's potential meets performance. This podcast is brought to you by Exola. Step into the future of game monetization with Exola. Exola empowers developers and publishers to market, sell, connect, and optimize their games globally. From payment solutions to a full suite of tools designed to grow your game's revenue while fostering a loyal player base, Exola is your game's gateway to worldwide success. With Exola, the world is your playground. Visit Exola.com today and find all the solutions that will help you to power your games into success everywhere. Moving on to one of our topics, there was a big kerfuffle this past weekend with Helldivers 2. So let me give you the recap of everything that went on. It was kind of like not nearly as bad as the Unity runtime fee. When, you know, we were like, ooh, what's going to happen now? But here's what happened. So what the hell happened with Helldivers 2? PlayStation has reversed course on the mandate that they were going to have players have to create PSN accounts. They were requiring players who even downloaded on Steam to set up a PSN account. So they're walking this back after the unpopular policy was going to go into place. So players put up 200,000 negative reviews on poor Helldivers 2's Steam page to you know, really help people know that they were not happy with this. Helldivers 2 has sold 8 million units as of March 2024 and has actually been a really great example of innovative live ops. I don't think they get enough credit for how they've been approaching that. All of that goodwill has now like just taken an absolute hit. I can't remember a comms nightmare like this since actually the Unity debacle. So one of the things that was interesting, and I can actually appreciate this, the developer is called Arrowhead, and their CEO did actually take a little bit of responsibility while still pointing a lot of fingers at Sony. He said, quote, "I do have a part to play. I'm not blameless in all of this. It was my decision to disable account linking at launch so that players could play the game. I did not ensure players were aware of the requirement, and we didn't talk enough about that. We knew for about 6 months before launch that it would be mandatory for online PlayStation titles." He then stepped in it a bit when players ask, well, why did you sell it in 177 countries if you knew you needed a PSN account and it was going to be, in a sense, delisted? So what happened was because you can't actually connect in 177 countries, so it just got delisted. And so people that downloaded it now could no longer play it. So because they've unfurled this policy, that's not the case anymore, but that was the case that they walked into. So huge kind of nightmare going on for everyone involved.
I wanted to ask, because I feel like that I didn't quite understand where the outrage came from, except for the understanding, okay, you buy this game, you start playing it, you love it, and then you're forced to sign in with PSN, which is only available in there's 177 non-PSN countries. So that part I get. But this also isn't the only game that seems to have a PC requirement for PSN sign-in, because they had the Ghost of Tsushima also requires a network account for its multiplayer mode, but not campaign. I'm the uninformed one. Maybe I represent a little bit of some of the other people who don't understand as listeners. Where's the rage coming from?
So first of all, remember they said on the Steam page that this would be coming. So they told people ahead of time, but you still could have bought it in a country that eventually would not have been usable because it would not be supported by the PSN account. So it's almost like your purchase now becomes defunct, which was obviously a mistake. Even if they told you that, like they are the least cost avoider, like they need to inform, they need to not list the product at all, because obviously they don't want that. But this is fine. Like Steam offered refunds. What's the outrage? You know, and you look at these countries, we can look at Steam reviews by language, and you look at the countries that are not supported by PSN accounts. It's not very many countries.
So this is about that the players that probably loved the game and now can no longer play. So that is the crux of the issue.
No. See, that's the misinformation, right? It's a vocal minority of people that don't want to do this PSN bullshit that are screaming bloody murder. And it doesn't really impact them at all, right? And the people that actually does impact are not the ones that are talking about this. I can't imagine. There's not enough people.
Yeah. Right?
It's like they're just bitching about something, right? So the way I interpret this whole thing is that, like, originally it was a requirement for PSN to do it. They shut it off because they wanted to make sure that the launch was as smooth as possible and there's less friction as possible, which was not a bad move, right? And then they tried to redo it because they were contractually required by Sony to do so, right? And then they just got fucking screwed. What was crazy is I read that the community manager of the company was the one that was telling people to bomb them on reviews on Steam because he didn't like the idea of actually creating PSN accounts, and he got subsequently fired, right? So I don't know. Whenever these like core gamers get all fucking hot and bothered about this bullshit and just create a big kerfuffle, I'm a little bit less like, this is a business, right? They want PSN accounts. They want people actively involved in the PSN ecosystem, right? If they're publishing it on fucking Steam, they want people to sign in with PSN, right? I think that's a God-given right, right?
For them,
you know? So I don't know, dude.
The problem is, from a comms perspective was you need to set players' expectations up front. So here's like a little bit of how I think about this from a comms perspective. I know, Phil, this is not necessarily like the crux of the issue, but here's how I would have communicated the need to do this. Because, Chris, you're right. Like, ultimately, to get more people into the game, the Arrowhead decided not to make people log in. But if you know that it's coming, you still need to account for that. So number one is set players' expectations early, which is exactly what he admitted they didn't do. You have to build trust with your community. You have to say it. You have to follow through with it. You have to let people know exactly what's coming. You have to over-communicate. If there's an issue, you have to be honest about it and speak in player speak, not in corporate PR speak, which they didn't even really necessarily get into this here because it just kind of came up on them like all of a sudden. So the reason why this was so quick is the policy was going to go into effect 4 days after they said that it was going to happen. So I think it was something like May 6th, the policy was supposed to go into effect. All those people were going to have to log in, and they gave people 4 days notice. Like, that's just absolutely horrific to do that to your player base. So the other thing is, as this was ongoing, they were not necessarily communicating really well. You know, make sure that you tell people, hey, I'll have an update for you by X time. And then at X time, come out and say, here's the update. That is how you kind of do proper crisis comms. And they didn't really even do that at this time. And, you know, where you can just be a little bit more open and honest. That's why I was like, I was really happy with how the Arrowhead CEO kind of talked about it. Because he's like, I'm kind of not, you know, I'm not innocent in all of this. Now, where they could have avoided a lot of this, too, was to offer very generous compensation. This is our speak for give players a lot of stuff to tell people you're sorry. In fact, they probably should have just done that from the beginning. They should have just said, listen, we're going to require you to log in with PSN. The benefit of logging in is you get to save your game, you get cross-platform, you get whatever the other benefits are. I don't even know what they are. And to do that, we're going to give you this free shit in the game.
I have teams that always ask this question when they have to make an economic change in the game. Do I rip off the Band-Aid and just say it very quickly and just implement it? Or do I announce it just like you suggested? Why do you think it was the right idea for them to instead move the date out rather than doing it 4 days? Because you can also build, they can build hype. These Redditors, they organize, they have an agenda, you know? and like once they form an agenda and they target something, like they can create just like, you know, just the vibe in the air. Why would that be a better strategy here? How much time should they give? Like, is 2 weeks the best time? Because they just did it. And like, look at this crisis happened and now it's over with and no one is going to give a shit about this in like a week. Right? This had no impact on player numbers. Now, of course, it wasn't implemented, so there wouldn't be any technical things, but like all this whining, it doesn't seem to move numbers. That's
But they pulled the requirement, right?
They did
pull the requirement. It's true.
So the vocal minority won.
It won. That's true.
You know?
Yep, they did win.
Which is, it's nice for players, but is extremely dangerous for companies moving forward, because now players know that they can, if they organize, which is what, you know, the internet allowed. I mean, this is Wall Street Bets, what Wall Street Bets did with the GameStop stock. So now that they know that they can win, everyone's kind of screwed. And so the idea is you're just going to have to get in front of it if you're a game developer and make sure that if you've got any really negative change that you need to do. The reason why I want to go earlier is you can engage them in conversation. And you can engage them and get their feedback and say, well, this week, you know, we're going to need to do this. Here's how we're approaching it. We really want to work with you to get your feedback on these types of things. It's kind of like hostage negotiation in a way. Great book, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, will teach you all about hostage negotiation. This is what it felt like to me. And they just caved right away. All right, Laura, you want to talk about Moon Active?
Yes, I do. Okay. So I mentioned earlier, Moon Active invests $50 million in Spike Games. I already talked about who Spike are. They made Tile Busters. They actually made a couple other games. And they also are making new games. But what I wanted to focus on was they're moving loudly, but not really loudly. What does this investment mean towards what they want to do in the future? So I went back just to have a quick look at their portfolio, because I think it shows a lot of, one, how clever they are, and two, the direction they're moving. So they have Family Island, which is a farming sim game with expeditions developed by Melsoft in 2018. And we've seen the expedition mechanic used in games like Viona's Farm by Ace Games, and then later in the version 2 of Township, with the 2020 plus version of Township. They obviously have Coin Master, which we've talked about today. They have Zen Match, which was another tile game originally developed by Good Job Games. Then they have Travel Town, which we've covered because of how how they've turned that game from, you know, earning a little bit of a revenue to becoming the top merge game earner in that subgenre, that merge subgenre. And that game was originally developed by Magmatic Games. Now they've invested in Spike for Tile Busters, which was also a tile match game like Zen Match, but they go a little bit harder on the social envelope that we've seen that was kind of started, you could say, by like Toy Toon Blast, but then has since evolved into very events heavy, very focused on competition. And they also have Blitz Busters. Spike has those two games now. Tile Busters, Blitz Busters. And I actually played about 50 levels of Blitz Busters last night just to get an idea of it. It's a match 3D, which is kind of the, you're picking up through a pile, kind of like a match factory with obstacles. They kind of take the same idea of like what works in puzzle games, obstacles. And then when I was playing it, I was like, wow, this looks really familiar. It is the same envelope. So the same meta envelope they use in Tile Busters, they use in Blitz Busters. So it looks like they just changed the core, which was very smart. It's what King is doing now, testing all their new games. They have a skeleton meta structure, of which then they're trying different, basically, core engine mechanics. So we see it with the Candy Crush Match 3D game, their Blast game. So quick to market, quick to test. And now you have two games at probably the cost of like what you were building, 1.5. And they also know... I also have a little bit of inside information. They're also working on an upcoming Match 3 game in-house. Oh. And I know because they're working with a friend of mine that's one of the best level designers I've ever worked with. If you look at that portfolio, aside from Coin Master, everything else is casual. And it's mostly casual puzzle. So they are definitely pivoting away from social casino into casual. And I was just taking a little bit of a look at Sensor Tower. And overall revenue by, you know, just super high level by those different genres. And casual and puzzle games out-earn casino on both platforms. The only exception in the Moon Active category, the portfolio, is the simulation game Family Island, which underperforms to casino only on Android. So I'm not surprised. And so far, when I had a look, and granted, Coin Master is still the main earner in all the games they have, they've made over $5 billion in lifetime revenue across their titles. And that's not even looking at the admon. I mean, Travel Town has some of the best implemented admon I've seen. And Coin Master, cool $2 million a day. Travel Town went from very, very small, and now they're earning $500,000 a day. I mean, I am really impressed.
Moon Active investing in this guys make a shit ton more sense than Griffin, right? So by the numbers, though, it looks like they're buying it basically at the same valuation as Griffin did 2 years ago, which is really interesting.
The game is down. The game is not showing growth.
It looks like they're maintaining the audience, but they're not spending. It's like they don't have enough money to like build. I don't know what's going on. I don't want to speculate, but yeah, it is down. This is like a flat round. This is not like, doesn't mean things are going 100% well. It's just things that, like, I think Moon Active is a lot better, more of a strategic investor, like, you know, to help them with publishing, to help them with, you know, building out live ops, to help them do more with the game potentially, or even fund their next game potentially. I don't know. But again, this makes a lot more sense than Griffin.
This is acquisition.
$55 million seat.
Right. What? Like the end road is acquisition, right? Like that. Why else would they make an investment like this?
Right. Right. They can invest in user acquisition. They can invest for potential adding it to their portfolio of products. And Moon Actives are gangsters, dude. Those guys really know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of respect what they do. So I think, you know, that it's a good place for them to be. And I'm sure they've been trying to get more active in terms of acquisition, and this could be a good setup for them, potentially.
Yeah, the Spike Games team is fantastic. A lot of the ex-peak from Toon Blast that was acquired by Zynga. So I looked a little bit, too, at Moon Active at a high level. And so revenue by country, U.S. is two-thirds of their total revenue. So it is, even though they aren't necessarily based in the U.S., the U.S. is a majority of their revenue, or US UK, I think, when you added those two together. I'm not sure how this is happening, but they're making $1 million a month in India on CoinMaster. You know, Chris especially, we give people a lot of shit for not being able to monetize India, but I was like, wow, that doesn't suck. CoinMaster is still, for Moon Active, 72% of their total revenue. Travel Town is now up to 16%, and that Family Island game is 13%. Zen Match, which is their other Zen game, which isn't Tile Busters, but Zen Match is only $1.2 million a month now, so not even that big of a deal. So expanding into other casual genres, I think, makes sense. Expanding into the team, I think, Cress, I think you're right about helping to, on the publishing side for Spike Games. I think one of the hardest things to do when you're a small company having a lot of success is how do you get the capital to continue the UA furnace of, you have to keep pumping coal into that UA furnace. And it feels like that's what Moon Active can come in and do for them and then have access to this amazing team. All right.
That just sounds like a publisher. Don't they just need a publisher? That's exactly what a publisher. That's literally what you just described, exactly. The publisher.
Well, isn't...
I know.
But maybe Moon Active is... I mean, that's kind of what they're doing, right?
Let's keep it simple, stupid. Let's keep it simple, dude, stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right.
Well, maybe that's Moon Active's new mandate is publishing. All right.
It's good to be back. Please stop giving Phil Spencer a pass. Like, this is bad, 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 bad news. I'm tired of listening. I can't believe I'm in agreement with Kotaku on this bullshit, right? It's like Kotaku's writing articles scathing against Phil Spencer, and I'm agreeing with Kotaku. Life is over.
So where does it end, though? This is what I keep asking, though. Like, I get it's bad, but, like, when does this end? For Microsoft, like, when do they shut up? When do they shut down? They just bought Activision, and they have egg on their face.
I know. And what I think is going to happen is ultimately they're going to divest out of this business.
Wow.
Like, that's what's going to happen.
That is crazy.
But it's going to take
crazy
a while, right?
Like,
I mean. Yeah, but this is going to take a while. Like, you know, but
what's the Middle
there's
Earth?
There's no reason for them to be in this business.
They can, like, split into three. Maybe they, like some of them can join, like, Middle Earth and Friends.
They could do an Embracer.
What is it? That was my favorite one.
Dude, that stock is up a lot. Oh my God, I read this. Well, we're not talking about Embracer. I said we wouldn't talk about Embracer. Okay, moving on.
Well, if their stock is up, is there something interesting? Wait, I want to hear.
No, it's like, it's speculative nonsense, right? Like, there's no value in any of their businesses, really, except for Asmodee, maybe. And even that's, like, laden with debt. So it's like, it's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be an epic nightmare. Anyway, all right, no more taking times off. I'm back. For a while. So yeah, we'll see you next week.
All right, see you next week.
You did it. You made it to the end of the episode. As a fan of the show, it would help us out if you subscribe and leave us a review on the podcast service of your choice. More importantly, are you a member of the Deconstructor of Fun Slack group? If you have 5 years or more of games industry experience, go to deconstructorofun.com/slack and apply to join. Join the games industry's best professional community filled with peers always willing to lend a hand. Or subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest insights from the Deconstructor of Fun content creators. Thanks for listening.